anniversary, the 50th anniversary of the end of World War II, that I ought to record or write down my experiences during the war for my kids or my grandkids. I haven't talked a whole lot about it. Some people, that's all they do talk about what experiences they had. But I've never felt comfortable talking about it. Not that I had it any worse than anybody else, but I've just never felt comfortable, so I didn't do it. I enlisted in the Army Air Corps in December 15th, 1942 in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and was sent to a reception center just out of Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and for shots, and you got a uniform there. And then they shipped you on down to, I went on down to Miami Beach for basic training. It was called the Army Air Corps at that time, as opposed to the Air Force now. But the Air Corps had taken over the whole Miami Beach. They took over all the hotels and the apartments and all that stuff. And that's where they had basic training. It's where they let you know who's going to run things. And I was down there about, a month or 6 weeks, I guess. And from there I went to radio school at Scottsfield, Illinois, to become a radio operator. And that lasted from probably February through June, I think. And what they taught you the Morse code there, and you had to attain a code speed of 18 words a minute. And they also taught you some theory about the radio. And they trained also the people that were going to operate radios on the ground, and also those that were going to operate them in the airplanes. And of course, the ones in the airplane, I had signed up to fly, so I was going to be a radio operator gunner. And so I graduated. I think I got out of there, and probably in June, because I know I went from there to Aerial Gunnery School in Laredo, Texas, and that was about June of 1943, because I was down in Laredo June, July, and August, and it was hot as hell down there. It was, some guy took an egg out there and cracked it on the runway, and it fried on the runway. It was so hot. It was really hot. But I was down there for, I think that lasted about 3 months, and then we went from there to, they sent us out to Salt Lake City. These were all these movements were on troop trains. And we got out to Salt Lake City, and they put us in the fairgrounds out there, and we were waiting there to be assigned to a bomber crew. They called them combat crews. And while I was there, I got a furlough. I went home back to Akron for about a week. Rode to Santa Fe, and I remember that, and back out. And then we got back out there, back to Salt Lake. They assigned us to a combat crew, and we were sent to Ardmore, Oklahoma. And then what we did at Ardmore was called phase training, and that was where you got your airplane, and you formed your combat crew, and that consisted of 10 men on a B-17. And which I was on, and they had four officers and six enlisted men, and the bombardier and the navigator and the pilot and the co-pilot were all officers, and they were all up in the front of the plane, and then the rest of us were gunners, were all enlisted men. We were all sergeants, and the crew consisted of the bombardier, navigator, and the pilot and co-pilot. And the engineer, he fired the top turret, and then the radio man, which I was, I had a gun position. And then the ball turret gunner, and then there was two waist gunners and a tail gunner. And the idea there, we had a couple of colonels that had flown 25 missions in with the 8th Air Force in England, and they were trying to train us under combat conditions, and we would get up in the morning and go to briefing, and they would have to go through the same thing they did over in England. They would have a target, and it might be Dallas, Texas, or somewhere, Houston, or Oklahoma City, or something like that. And you'd get in your plane, and they'd all take off, and you'd form in formation, and they were teaching you to fly real close, and the theory was that they didn't want you to get out by yourself, because German fighters would love to pick off the individual air bomber. But as long as the bomber was in a group, it was more protected, and they had more firepower, and that was a theory, and that was what we were training to do. Everybody was trained to do their job. I had to get on a radio net and send message back to the base in code and take messages from them and that kind of stuff. But we were down, I don't know quite when we left. I did have one. The pilot we had down there was a fellow named Smith, Robert Smith, and he was he's from up in New England somewhere, and a real nice guy. I think he had been he started out as a private in the Army, and then he had, somehow or another, he'd gone to OCS and came out and went to pilot training. He became a pilot. He was a real nice guy, and we didn't have a full crew, and we were a couple guys short, and they kept putting off part of the training down there. Was we had to go up and fly to shoot at a tow target from the B-17, and they kept putting that off because we didn't have a full crew. And finally, late in December, we were to go down to Galveston, Texas, and fly out over the Gulf, and there would be a plane out there towing a target that we could shoot at. So we get down to the airfield down in the it was cold, and there wasn't enough plane. They didn't have enough planes to get down there. There was just a few of them that were flyable. So this one crew, I'd flown with them one day when their radio operator was sick, but they were going down. They had a full crew. So our pilot and I believe the bombardier and the navigator, of course they were good friends, and they went along down with him, and he was going down there to pick up a plane down in Galveston and bring it back up to Ardmore, and then we were going to go back down with him. And they took off about a half hour after they were off, an officer came in and told us they'd crashed out there, and there was 14 of them killed in that plane. They had a whole lot of ammo on it, and it all cooked off, and they weren't up high enough for anybody to get out. So I always remember that, because this guy was he was a super guy. And then they assigned us another pilot, and we picked up some more of another bombardier and navigator. And this guy, the pilot they assigned to us, was from New Rochelle, New York, and he'd been an instructor down there, and he was a real pain in the butt, you know. No, we just didn't like him from the word go. So these two colonels that were running the show down there, they had, like I say, they'd done their 25 missions over in the 8th Air Force and finished up. And they flew when there wasn't any fighter support, and it was really, it was always tough, but it was a lot tougher then. So these colonels told us they they wanted this, these combat crews to operate as a team, and if we had any problems with our pilot or anything, come talk to them, because they wanted this thing, teamwork was the key, and that's what they wanted. So after several weeks of this guy, and we were all of us enlisted men were really ticked off at him and just didn't like him, just hated him. And finally they decided, we decided among us that myself and another guy, the ball turret gunner, would go talk to the colonel and see if, what could be done. So Oase and I went over to talk to the colonel, and we told him what our problem was and why we didn't like him, and he was real nice, and he says, well, I'll tell you what, Sergeant, you'll have a new pilot on Monday. So apparently the pilot got the word, because Ace and I were walking up the street at the base the next day, and this guy comes by in a car, and he stopped the car and asked us to get in. So we got in, and he starts trying to talk us out of what we had done, you know. Man, Oase started to waffle a little bit. And I thought, man, I come this damn far, that was bad enough. I ain't gonna back off now. So I said, nope. That's the way it is. And by God, come Monday, he's back this pile. So we didn't get rid of him as hard as we tried. So anyway, then when we finished up phase training there, which wasn't too much longer, we flew to Grand Island, Nebraska. And that's where you got your new airplane, the new B-17, the one you were going to take to England. So we got up there, and we got caught in a blizzard. And I remember that. We were in the base up there and had to stay in there a day or two. And we flew the plane around there a couple days, the pilot did, and then they decided we were ready to go. So we took off for, I think we were going to Presque Isle, Maine. And that was one of the jumping off places for the Air Corps. So we started out, and we had problems when we got, we had to transfer the fuel from one tank to the other. The transfer valve jammed or didn't operate properly, and we couldn't get the gas into the other tank, so we had to make an emergency landing in Rochester, New York. And he put it down in a little damn airfield that had Piper Cubs on it, you know, and they thought we were from Mars, because this plane was so damn big. And the pilot did a hell of a good job putting that thing in there. Apparently he could fly all right, but he got it in there, boy, and we had our 45s and got out of there, and like somebody was going to attack us, you know. But they took the plane from there. The nearest place they could work on it was Rome, New York. So they flew the plane over to Rome, put some gas in it, flew it over there, and they put us on a bus over to Syracuse Air Base. That was the nearest air base for us. So we stayed there while they worked on the plane over Rome. And we were at Syracuse for a couple weeks, I guess, while they were fixing that thing, and then they finally thought they had it fixed. And so we took off, and we went to Gander, and I guess that's in Newfoundland, but we stopped. That was a big jumping off place too, so we stopped there, and they we told them we were having trouble with the valve on the tanks, and they said, well, they couldn't fix it there, and they weren't, and we weren't sure that it was fixed. So when we were to go from there to Scotland, so what they decided to do was have us go from Gander on over to Iceland, but we would veer a little bit to the left towards Greenland, so in case something happened, we would still have enough fuel to get to Greenland. But to make a long story short, nothing happened. We got to Iceland just fine, and then from Iceland to Scotland, we landed in Prestwick, Scotland. And that would have been in March of 44. And we landed Prestwick, and then they took our plane there. I don't know where they went with that. And then we got on a train and went to a place called Bobbing. Well, we went from Prestwick to Glasgow, Scotland. I remember we were there one night. And then from Glasgow, we went on over to a place called Bobbington. And I think they also had another name called Hemel Hempstead. It was just south of London. And this was a place, sort of a staging area, where all the air crews came. And then they assigned you from there, they assigned you to your combat unit. So while you were there, they made you go through a refresher course in your specialty. And of course, mine was radio. And I had to, they made the radio operators increase their code word speed from 18 words a minute to 20, which I did. And of course, the engineers had to go through a refresher in engineering school, and the armorers had to go to armorer school, and so forth. But anyway, we tried to dump this pilot. We talked to the guy who was in charge of that air base there, and we tried to dump the pilot again, and the guy, and he says, well, wait till you get to your next, to your combat unit, and all this kind of stuff. Anyway, we were assigned to the 306th Bomb Heavy Bombardment Group at Thurley, England, which is near Bedford, England. And we got there in early April of 44. And the policy that they were using, they would take the pilots that came in on a new cruise and they would put them in the co-pilot seat of an experienced crew and let them fly a few missions with an experienced crew to get the feel of what the hell went on up there, rather than putting a greenhorn on an airplane and have him flying around not knowing what he's doing. So they our pilot and navigator went up on the same aircraft, and they got shot down on the first mission. So there our crew is without a pilot or a navigator, so they split our crew up and made us replacements. And radar operators were in higher demand than anything else among enlisted men, so I got assigned a crew right away. And I got assigned a crew that had about 18 missions in. And so I flew, I don't know when that first, I think my first mission was April the 18th, and that was to Orenburg. It was a suburb of Berlin, and I know we had a camera on our ship, and it was mounted in the bomb bay, and I was supposed, when we started our bomb run, I was supposed to, my job was to go up there and open the door into the bomb bay and turn that camera on. And we didn't have any fighters attack us, and we didn't have any problems at all. We get to the target, and I go up, and the bomb bay doors are open, and I'm in there, and I'm turning that switch, and I'm looking down there, and I see these orange puffs coming up there, and kept looking at, you know, it was bursting, it was flak, and I was so damn dumb I didn't hardly know what it was. It wasn't close enough, you know, it wouldn't make any, it was bursting way below us. But then we didn't have any problem at all, and we come back from that mission, and those guys, the old guys, the enlisted guy says, well, what'd you think of that? And I says, oh, hell, this ain't bad, you know. And they, boy, it really ticked them off, because they'd been through some hairy ones. And that, and if you had 18, you'd lived about three lifetimes in that length of time. But then the next mission I went on, just a day or two later, was to a place called Kassel in Germany, and that was a tank. That was a tank factory we were bombing, and we got in all kind of problems there. We got we didn't have any fighter attacks. But I remember when we hit the initial point, which they call the IP, and that's where you turn on your bomb run, and the bombardier flies the plane in conjunction with the bomb site, so he can line up the the plane with the sight and everything on the target. And I heard him say over the intercom, he says, "Do we have to fly through that stuff?" You know, and he was talking about the flak, and apparently they'd got the right altitude with the flak. And boy, we hit that stuff, and sounded like guys were out there beating on that airplane with ball bats, you know, and then the navigator screamed over there. He says, I'm blind, and we'd taken a hit up in the front, you know, and the bombardier got hit, and then he was hit in the chest. He had a flak suit on, so it didn't kill him, it knocked him unconscious. And sprayed plexiglass all through the nose up there, and that's what got in the navigator's eyes. So then I heard the pilot say, "They got number two. They got number two." And I look out I had a little window there, and it's on fire. And he had an extinguisher. They have an extinguisher built in there, and he got the fire out, but they had to feather the prop, so they were short an engine on that one. And then about 2 minutes later, he hollers, "They got number three," and that's one on the other side. And it was spurting oil out of it, but they had to feather that, so we're flying on two engines, and we're trying to stay up with this, with the group, because we didn't want to get out. You didn't want to be out by yourself, because that's when the Germans would jump on you big time, like flies on or gnats on a fly or something like that. But he needed to know, he called me, the pilot called me to get a magnetic bearing to fly back to our base, so I had encoded a message, send back there, and he just encoded it and sent it back there, and you held your key down on your radio key, and you'd hold that down. That would send a constant sound, and they'd pick that up, and they could tell what bearing you'd have to fly to get home. And that was really all what a radio operator was on there for, basically. And I got the message back and relayed it up to the pilot, and we kept hooking on to these groups until there wasn't any groups left. We couldn't keep up. And by the time we got to the French coast, we were by ourselves. And we got back over the channel, and we were losing altitude, but we finally got back to base, and we shot off the flares to let them know there was wounded aboard, and everybody else was home by then. And God, we're starting to land, and we're coming down, and the radio, the door from Bombay opens up, and the smoke comes flying through there, and the engineer is there. He says, come on up front with me. We've got a fire on the hydraulic motor," and this is right back of the pilot seat there. So I went up there, and we were beating on this. He had some rags, and we put the fire out, but it was smoking. We're landing at the same time, and as soon as we hit the ground, I heard the pilot say, "Jesus Christ, we don't have any brakes." You know, the fluid had leaked out of them. But we're rolling down this damn runway, and down at the end of the runway, there was a grassy field. I didn't know it at the time. There was a grassy field, and then there was another runway going the opposite way from it. And there's a bunch of ground crew sitting there on a damn truck, you know, and they didn't know. They assumed that the thing was going to stop. Well, this old pilot's hollering, get out of the way. And we didn't know what the hell he was hollering about, but what happened was we ran down into that field before the damn thing stopped. And they got the bombardier off of there, and he lived. I don't know how badly he was hurt, because about three more days and I was gone. We had a new bombardier and a new navigator on the next mission. Well, after that mission, I knew damn good and well there's no way in hell I was going to finish 30 missions. And I went back to the barracks and I got the stuff I had and just wrote on there where I wanted my picture stamped and all that kind of stuff, because I was thoroughly scared. I really was. And that I can remember those. We lived in Quonset huts, and they would come. They'd get you up real, real early. I want to say 2:30 in the morning, and a guy would come through, and he'd have the list of the crews that were going to fly that day, and he'd stop in each barracks and go in there and turn on the lights and wake everybody up and read off the names of the crews, you know. And man, I could, after that mission, I'd lay awake. I could hear him two or three barracks down, you know. And they'd come to ours, and I'd go, "Oh, to Christ, I'm not going." But he'd come, you know, and he'd call off those names. And then you'd go to breakfast, and then you'd go, I don't know the engineers. I know I went to the radio man went to the briefings with the pilots and the co-pilots. I don't know whether the engineer went or not, but the other gunners didn't have to go, and they'd have this big curtain up there, and the CO would be up there, you know, and we got everybody seated and everything. Well, he'd open this curtain, and there would be the map, and there'd be a piece of yarn on there from Thur Lake to wherever the hell you were supposed to go that day, and it all in. You always wanted to see a short piece of yarn, but it was always long, you know. But then after briefing, you'd go out and load up. But when I think back, one of the things I'm really, I don't say proud of, but I'm kind of glad of, is that there's radio operators that probably flew 50 missions and never had to contact their base, because you always maintained radio silence. You weren't supposed to even talk. Well, there wasn't much talking at that time. It was all code wave. You didn't talk. You couldn't talk back to base if you wanted to, because voice transmission didn't carry that far. But everything had to be done with code, and it wasn't like the airplanes today. There weren't pressurized cabins. There was terrible noisy. You couldn't hardly hear. You couldn't stand there hardly and talk to somebody. It was so noisy. And then you have to take these dits and dahs over something like that, and it's real scary. And I remember I went on a mission to Merseburg. And it was an oil refinery, and that was a long piece of yarn, by the way. It was, I don't know where the hell it was, but it was an oil refinery. And it was real foggy that morning, and we took off. This was probably the third mission. And we took off. They said that get up above 18,000, it's clear up there, and you guys can form up there. So you take all these airplanes off into the fog, and you're going up there, and you know, everybody's got they're looking 360 degrees, looking all around, trying to make sure you don't run into any airplanes. And you're always the pilot tells you, everybody watch now and holler if you see anything. And that was real hairy. And we get up to 18,000, and it's as bad as 18 as it is on the ground, and nobody can find anybody. And they finally sent a recall, and I got that, and that's the only other mission message I ever got. But normally, you just, as far as radio, man, they maintained radio silence over, in combat, you didn't operate the radio unless it was an emergency. And as luck would have it, we did have an emergency, and I was glad. I was so scared. I was glad I could do it, being as scared as I was. But they say that's what it's all about. But anyway, then after that mission, we went to Ham, those railroad yards. That wasn't very long, and I don't know where that, I guess that's in Germany. But we didn't have any problems with that one. But then on the fourth one, the one I got shot down on, this was on April the 24th, so if the first one was on the 18th and the last one's on the 24th, I didn't have much time in combat. But what time I had was kind of hairy. And I remember when we met at the airplane after briefing, well, the pilot, this guy's name was James, and he says, we were flying over around Munich, and he says, boy, if we get in any trouble today, we're going to Switzerland, you know. So we take off, and as I recall, it was a pretty nice day. It was a nice day. But those missions were long, you know. You'd take off maybe at 8 o'clock or in the morning, and you wouldn't get back till 5. Real long, long. This one was a long one. And we're getting over there around, I don't know where, we were getting near Munich. Our target was a place called Oberhofenpfaffen, a real crazy name, and it was a gear works, a Dornier gear works is what it was for Dornier aircraft. And at 3 o'clock, we could see there was a group getting hit out there. There was fighters attacked in that group out there, and they were quite a ways from us. But then all of a sudden I heard somebody up front say, here they come, 12 o'clock, you know. So I'm looking out, I'm looking at 6 o'clock, I'm looking out the back end of the airplane, and these guys are coming from the front, so I never see them, you know. I just see them after they're going by, you know, shoot at them. And they first pass, what they were doing at that end, at that time, the Germans decided that they would attack in formation instead of single, sending one or two down through there. They'd gang up and maybe send 10 or 15 at one time. And they'd meet your formation with a formation of fighters. These fighters were ME-109s, and they were a damn good airplane. And the Germans had another good fighter, the Focke-Wulf 190, was a real good fighter. But they crippled us on that first pass. We were done because they hit the central power system, and all the electrical system went out. And I was, of course, I'm looking out the back and shooting, and I remember seeing a big hole in the horizontal stabilizer. It was all peeled back like a banana. It must have been 20 millimeter hit that thing. But we started down, and we're trying to get the guy, one of the waist gunners and myself, we're trying to get the guy up out, Earl Wynn up out of the ball turret. Everett Minow was a waist gunner. And Minow and I are trying to, we have hand cranks. It's an electrically operated turret, but the electricity was shot. So we cranked it up, and we got Earl back up into the airplane. And I think the other waist gunner, Jim Copeman, went back and got the tail gunner, Walt Lastinger. He had to crawl back here and get him. He couldn't use the intercom. The intercom went out too. So everything had to be head-to-head. You couldn't talk to anybody. And when we're doing this, well, then the engineer comes back from up front. His gun position is upright. He's firing the top turret right up behind the pilot. And he came back, and he told Everett and I that everybody's gone up front. And Everett and I, to this day, presumed that he meant everybody was dead. But we went on out the back. We all jumped out of the waist, and I remember George Vogt was the engineer. He said, let me go before you, Everett, because I'm afraid I might not jump. And as it turned out, I found out later that a lot of guys frozen, they just didn't jump. They just went on down. They couldn't do it. So He got in that doorway and he's standing there. He stood there a little too long and somebody booted him out. And then we all went out after him. And we'd been trained to, I shouldn't say trained. We never had any damn parachute training. They had a chest chute, a small chest chute. The paratroopers used that as an emergency chute. But we would wear our harness and then we would clip the chute on it. It was a little boxy affair thing. And we were instructed when we got to England to delay our jump till the objects on the ground became distinguishable. So they didn't want you in the air too long because they said the Germans had been known to shoot you while you were in your chute. So we delayed it. I delayed my jump as long as I could. And it seemed like an eternity, but finally pulled the ripcord, and it worked, and it was a beautiful day. I remember it was bright and sunny. I don't think I was in the air too long, and I landed in a plowed field, and hell, I was trying to gather up my chute, and while I was gathering that up, a farmer came up with a gun, and that was it, so. That was the end of my flying anyway. And then from there they took me to an air base and put me in a cell by myself, and I was there for a day or two. And then they took me out and put us on a train, and I found out they gathered up the other enlisted men. I don't think any pilot, none of the pilots, the co-pilot, the bombardier navigator, none of those guys were with us. But they gathered up, the rest of the enlisted men were there, and they put us on a train and took us to Frankfurt, Germany for questioning. We found out about 40 years later, Everett Minow ran into the guy that was flying co-pilot on our aircraft. His name was Vandermeer. And Vandermeer told him about what happened to the guys up front. The bombardier had broken leg, and I guess Vandermeer had gotten hit, and he was supposedly the last guy out of the ship. But apparently those four guys got out too, and Everett and I thought for years and years that when George said they were all gone up there, we both interpreted it to mean that they were all dead. But apparently they all got out, which is a blessing. But getting back to the story, they took us to Frankfurt, to a place called Dulag Luft. They took all the air prisoners there to question them. And on the way there, we had a very hairy experience. They had two German non-coms taken. There was about six of us. And they picked up a Mustang, a P-51 pilot, and I remember his eyes were real red. I don't know whether it had been fire or what, but his eyes, the whites of his eyes were red, you know, like he had a tremendous hangover. But he was with this group, I remember, and we had to change trains in Augsburg, Germany, and it had been bombed flat pretty much. We'd hit it in the daytime, the 8th would hit it in the daytime, and the RAF would hit it at night, and the railroad station was just a bunch of rubble. And we had all his flight stuff on. Anybody knew we were air crew members because we had the big heavy boots and the heavy jackets and crap on. And the little guy was a corporal, and I think a big guy, that big sort of dumb guy, was a private. And the little guy we had to make train connections there, and he went up somewhere in the station to get the connections taken care of, and he left us with this private. And we're sitting there, he had to sit on this big hunk of big batch of pile of rubble there. It was dirt and rock and busted glass and stuff like that. And we're sitting there, and this train master is a guy in a uniform. Of course, he sees us, and they know right away what the hell we are. And he starts ranting and raving, and pretty soon he's got a damn crowd there. And by God, the crowd's gonna lynch. They're coming after us. It's getting worse by the minute. And just about the time they're gonna make a move, where the little corporal comes back, and he gets there, and he takes us, and he runs us into some kind of a washroom, and locked the door. And somehow or another, they got those people calmed down. But I thought, if that little bugger hadn't gotten back there, that could have got awful bad. But then from there, we went on to, I remember we stopped in Mannheim. We got there at night, and it was, we were on a regular passenger train, and we were in this passenger compartment, and there was other civilians. The trains were packed. The civilians were outside in the aisles, and the RAF came over and had an air raid while we were there, and they pulled the train out of the station right outside of town, and they had guns on top of this thing. They had some kind of, you could hear them shooting these guns off this thing, but that was kind of scary. But then we get into Frankfurt, and Frankfurt was all bombed out, you know, for miles before you got in there. Why, there's burnout railway cars and stuff like that. I'm sure they rebuilt the tracks 100 times. But then they took us to a little place outside of town that they called Dulag Luft, where they questioned all the air crew members. And they would take you in there with a guy that spoke English, and they told us what to expect when we were in England. They said they'll want to know where your target was, and what your altitude was, and what the bomb load was, and who your pilot was. They'll want to ask you all that stuff, and they'll tell you it's a Red Cross form, and all you were ever supposed to tell them is your name, rank, and serial number. So sure enough, I get in there with this guy, and he could speak English better than I could, and he starts asking me this question, and just for the hell of it, I said, "Is this a Red Cross form?" And he said, "Yeah." And I said, "Well, I can give you my name, rank, and serial number, you know." And then he says, "Well, I guess we'll have to we'll just have to shoot you as a spy, because we don't know whether you're an Air Force from the U.S. Air Force or not," and they give you a bunch of garbage like that, you know. But then he told me he'd been a bank clerk in Hackensack, New Jersey, but he spoke great English. And anyway, they put you in solitary, a place by yourself, and they had so damn many prisoners coming so fast that they had to move. I was in there at the most 2 days, and I was at, then they moved you down into a compound with the other guys that had already gone through what you'd gone through, and then you waited there for your boxcar to take you to prison camp. And it's kind of interesting, because while I was there, I saw the guy, this pilot of the crew that I went over from the States with, that we were trying so hard to get rid of. Well, we all thought back at the base that he'd been killed, because they said that nobody saw any chutes come out of that airplane. But I saw his name on the wall there, so I knew he was still gone. So he'd made it. And that happened in a lot of cases when you come back from a mission. They would ask, when a plane went down, how many chutes did you see? And they'd have to report how many you saw. And some planes that went down blew up so quick that there was no chutes. People say no chutes. But he was, I saw his name on the wall, so I knew he'd made it. But funny thing with the Germans, they segregated the officers and the enlisted men, and they had segregated the Air Force personnel from the infantry. They had separate camps for the enlisted Air Force crew members, and then they had a separate prisons for the officers in the Air Force. They had separate prisons for the from the infantry. So we went. I was sent to a Stalag 17B, which was at Krems, Austria, and we got on this box car at Frankfurt, and there must have been 40 or 50 guys on there. You couldn't, if you got up to go to the door to take a leak, you couldn't. You lost your place. You know that it was that crowded, and some of the guys were wounded, and their wounds were infected, and it was terrible. And then the guards took. They put a chain across about a third of the car, and they took a third, and they had all kind of room there for about three or four of them with machine guns. And so I'm not sure how long it took to get to Krems. I want to think about a week, because they'd move us over to the side and let troop trains go by. But we finally made it to Krems.